Now, President Barack Obama and race. Thomas Sugrue is a professor of history and sociology, as well as director of the Penn Social Science and Policy Forum at the University of Pennsylvania. He is president of the Urban History Association and author of Not Even Past, Barack Obama and the Burden of Race. Tom Sugrue joins us this morning from the studios of WXPN in Philadelphia. Tom, so good to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Well, this president is a reconciler and who's not into confrontation. I'm wondering, why is that? Where did that approach originate in his life? Because you get the impression that he really does like to avoid confrontation, whether the issue is race or the federal budget. Where did this notion of the president as reconciler come from in his life?
Yeah, in many respects, Obama sees himself as the reconciler in chief, as someone who can present both sides in a debate with a reasonable compromise, a middle ground that can bring people together despite their differences. In some ways, I mean, some have argued that it goes all the way back to his childhood and to his family dynamics. I'm not a psychohistorian, so I'll look at what are some of the more immediate roots, which are in Obama's activism as a community organizer in Chicago, and particularly his time at Harvard Law School, where he forged a very interesting alliance between seemingly incompatible groups, that is, African-American and liberal students and conservative students. In both Chicago and at Harvard, Obama believed that problems get solved when you find common ground and listen and then present what seems to be a reasonable halfway point between the positions of either sides. In Chicago, that was his efforts to try to bring together black and Latino and white workers who had been displaced by the collapse of industry. The strategy that he had as an organizer was forge an interracial coalition to work to improve the living conditions of working class Chicagoans. It was a tough road to hoe, to be sure, but it was a paradigm that shaped his later politics. And then when he was at Harvard, Obama ran to be president of Harvard Law Review,
right,
maybe the most prestigious position a person can have there as a student. And to win, he needed to win over a pretty significant faction of conservative students, members of the Federalist Society, which is a conservative student law group, who were profoundly suspicious of him. And you know, Harvard at that time was a bitterly divided place. It was nicknamed the Beirut of legal education. So Obama reached out to both sides and said to the conservative students, you guys might not agree with me on everything, but I'll respect you. I'll include you in the process, making decisions about what articles to publish. And they accepted that rationale and were persuaded to line up and provide him with some critical votes in the contested election to be elected Harvard Law Review president.
You know, you do wonder, again, going back to the roots of all this, you mentioned his family and who knows what the dynamics were there. And you also wonder about this sort of laid-back Hawaiian upbringing that he had as a kid, you know, and the impact that might have had on this sort of conciliatory approach to confrontation.
Yeah, I mean, some date it back to his, you know, his childhood when he spent time with his mother in Indonesia, where she was doing research for her dissertation in anthropology. Others talk about it coming from the kind of the laid-back, multi-ethnic world of Hawaii that he came of age in. And I think there's plausibility to both of those arguments. It's hard to prove. But surely he was shaped by the internal dynamics of his own family life. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
You know, why have African-Americans and liberal Democrats, for that matter, more or less tolerated this approach to governing, this style of governing, as opposed to something more confrontative, which you would assume that many would have preferred to have seen from him by now, given the fact that he's the first African-American president of this country?
I think the fact he's the first African-American president has made him already, you know, he's predisposed not to be a conflictual person, but I think being the first African American president has also put some boundaries around what he can say. He doesn't want to risk being called an angry black man, and indeed, any moment that he mentions race, you know, during the campaign, during his first 5 years in office, critics come out and say, he's playing the race card. He's showing that he's really a pent-up radical about to explode with bitterness around the question of race. He's worsening the racial divisions in the country rather than healing them. You know, even the mere mention of race arouses that kind of anger on the part of his critics. So in some ways, he's both by his disposition and by the political constraints of being perceived as a radical, he's very cautious, very calm, very conciliatory in his approach. But look, his supporters during the election of 2008 especially, but even you know for a few years afterwards, many of them believed that that he was someone to the left of the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. And many of his opponents believed it too. That was in some ways a projection of their own hopes and fantasies onto Obama. If you read, as I did, pretty much everything that he wrote or said between the mid-1980s and his election in 2008, this is not someone who is a Black Panther waiting to be uncaged or a civil rights activist who is going to bring protest politics to the White House. He's someone who's incredibly disciplined, focused, and someone whose politics moved very much toward the moderate wing of the Democratic Party. He came up in the age of Bill Clinton, and in many respects, despite their personal differences and stylistic differences, he's very much that kind of middle-of-the-road Democrat.
Well, what a paradox you're outlining here, though, because on the one hand, Tom, you're describing the fact that obviously we have the first African-American president elected in 2008, reelected in 2012. That seems to suggest some progress on race. And then on the other hand, you're describing the first African-American president who is cautious, won't confront folks over this issue to any extent because it'll cost him so dearly politically. And then I guess the question then becomes, a lot of folks suggest that we're in this post-racial time period now in America in the wake of electing the first African-American president. Are we really?
No. I think the argument that somehow we're in a post-racial or post-civil rights era overlooks the ways in which race is still deeply embedded in every aspect of American life. I mean, just a couple of basic facts, right? The economic crisis beginning in 2008 has affected all Americans, but it's fallen particularly heavily upon racial minorities who are more likely to be subject to foreclosures because of the crisis in the housing and mortgage industry. They're significantly more likely to be unemployed than white Americans. And so we're all affected by it. It's been devastating nationally, but the effects are still borne disproportionately by African Americans. So,
and you don't hear the president talk about that often. He does mention it, but he doesn't really dwell on that point very much.
No, he hasn't talked about it often. And some of his really fervent supporters, say, for example, the theologian and Professor Cornel West, have been really bitterly disappointed at the fact that Obama hasn't used the White House to really make a charge on these still unresolved problems of racial inequality. I would say it's a slightly more complicated story than that. Obama, by and large, has put racial and civil rights issues and questions of inequality well down the list of the presidential to-do list. That is, they haven't been central to his administration. He's been more concerned with foreign policy and more concerned with the macroeconomic sorts of issues, particularly on the finance side. Mm-hmm. And I think his critics are right to say, his administration didn't put a lot of priority on dealing with unemployment at the crucial moment, especially in 2008 and 2009 when the bottom fell out. On the other hand, behind the scenes, mostly off radar, in the arcane workings of the various government agencies, civil rights programs are moving forward. That Department of Housing and Urban Development has been dealing with segregation and integration and discrimination in the housing market. The Department of Justice which essentially shut down a good part of its civil rights work during the previous administration, has again renewed its attention on voting rights, housing, and discrimination in other arenas. And so that's mostly happening in a way that it's never going to make the headlines, but it's important behind the scenes.
Let's do this, Tom, when we come back. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation here. Let's talk about the big speech that then-candidate Barack Obama gave in March 2008, where he really addressed this issue of race head-on and what that says about the way Barack Obama approaches this whole issue of race. And for our listeners, do you think President Obama has advocated enough for civil rights issues since taking office, or is it all right that they're taking a backseat to other issues like foreign policy, the economy, and health care? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us at uptodate@kcur.org, or finally, you can tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation with the book doctors, you can find that and all of our previous broadcasts. Just go to kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, we'll get an inside look from the trenches of family court. Plus, Brian McTavish swings by with our weekend to-do list. This hour, we're talking about President Barack Obama and the issue of race. We're joined today by Tom Sagru. He's a professor of history and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Not Even Past, Barack Obama and the Burden of Race. And I should point out that Tom will be speaking tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Kansas Union on the KU campus over in Lawrence. The title of his talk is The Education of Barack Obama, Race and Politics in the Age of Fracture. More information about that on our website, kcur.org. Well, Tom, the president, then he was a candidate, I guess, in March of 2008. The presidential race is in full swing, and he gave a big speech on race. I want to get your reaction to the speech, but let's listen to a cut from it right now.
I chose to run for president at this moment. I believe deeply that we cannot solve the challenges of our time unless we solve them together, unless we perfect our union by understanding that we may have different stories, but we hold common hopes, that we may not look the same and may not have come from the same place, but we all want to move in the same direction towards a better future for our children and our grandchildren. And this belief comes from my unyielding faith in the decency and generosity of the American people. But it also comes from my own story. I'm the son of a black man from Kenya and a white woman from Kansas. I was raised with the help of a white grandfather who survived a depression to serve in Patton's army during World War II, and a wild white grandmother who worked on a bomber assembly line at Fort Leavenworth while he was overseas. I've gone to some of the best schools in America, and I've lived in one of the world's poorest nations. I am married to a black American who carries within her the blood of slaves and slave owners, an inheritance we pass on to our two precious daughters. I have brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, uncles, and cousins of every race and every hue scattered across three continents. And for as long as I live, I will never forget that in no other country on earth is my story even possible. It's a story that hasn't made me the most conventional of candidates, but it is a story that has seared into my genetic makeup the idea that this nation is more than the sum of its parts, that out of many, we are truly one.
You know, Tom, you listen to that speech, and again, I haven't listened to it now for, I guess, since he gave it. Boy, you really do hear a man speaking there who, at least on paper, I think a lot of us could probably agree, if you're going to have the first president of color, he probably fits the resume of someone you might pick for that job, just based on what we heard there.
Definitely. He's essentially using his own family history to link himself to every group in the United States. You know, for common different stories and common hopes is one of the themes that he pulls out here. And you know, his family is a family of lots of different stories, and in a way, that's the America that he's aspiring to pull together. And here you hear that same theme again of pulling together, overcoming differences, finding commonality. That is, I think, one of the essential elements of a Barack Obama's political persona.
And again, nothing confrontative about it in the least.
No, not in the least. And remember, this speech comes out right in the middle of the brouhaha over Obama's minister in Chicago.
I was just going to ask you. Yeah, set up for us why he gave this speech to begin with.
Well, his pastor, Jeremiah Wright, who Obama first met when he was a community organizer in Chicago in the 1980s, Wright was known for his advocacy of what he called black liberation theology. He was a real critic of American foreign policy and of business. He also was an advocate of black self-help and personal responsibility and initiative, part of the story that got overlooked at the moment. But he gave a famous speech in which he criticized American foreign policy, and he used the three words that got repeated again and again: God damn America, right? And immediately Barack Obama faced a crisis. Was he in fact someone who adhered to this critique of American foreign policy of his minister? And he had to distance himself from that. And he did so not by simply repudiating the words of the Reverend Wright, but by telling another story, telling a story of commonality, of shared hopes and shared dreams, of building bridges, and of reminding listeners that just because the Reverend Wright said this in his sermons didn't mean that Barack Obama adhered to them. In fact, Obama said he wasn't even there when that sermon was given, which, given how much he traveled, is probably true.
And to be sure, Tom, the then candidate Obama, he's walking a very, very thin tightrope at this point, because he is trying to distance himself from Jeremiah Wright, but at the same time, he can't disown him completely. In fact, he said at one point in the speech, "I can no more disown him than I can disown the black community. I can no more disown him than I can disown my own white grandmother." So again, an extremely difficult task he's trying to navigate here.
Yes, and I think Obama was able to really pull that off brilliantly, precisely because at various points in the speech, he reaches out and tries to find that common ground with different audiences. So to whites, he talks about his grandmother. To African Americans, he talks about the fact that he and Wright are part of a black community. And to folks who are skeptical that being part of that community will make him an effective leader and president, he says, ultimately, we may be different, but what we share is a belief that we can work together to transform America, to make it a better place, to make it safer, to make it more economically secure, to provide jobs and opportunity for people regardless of their background. So he recognizes difference, but he eventually hones in on what we share.
Well, speaking of walking tightrope, so again, we're talking about President Barack Obama and the issue of race. Let's go to some phone calls here at 816-235-2888, our email address, update@kcur.org. Mike from Lawrence. Mike, good morning.
Thanks for taking my call. You're right. He walks a really, really fine line. As a Native person, I kind of commend him for sticking his neck out for the XL pipeline, but at the same time, some of the solar projects have upset sacred sites. He's put land and protection in Colorado for sacred sites, but he couldn't protect our wetlands from a traffic way. But it's kind of a quandary. And I look at Tom Cole the same way, the Republican Chickasaw congressman, who defended and commended President Obama's Indian initiatives while his own party repudiated them. It's kind of a real tough walk for minorities when dealing with the larger population in politics and trying to keep their own constituents happy.
Mike, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Tom, let's sit back here and trace a little bit more the president's approach to race and how it was shaped over the course of his lifetime. Let's just walk through the various stages of his life, and let's begin with Hawaii. What would you say, in addition to what you've already said about his upbringing in Hawaii?
Well, Hawaii is one of the most diverse places in the United States. There's no single group that's in the majority. There are Native Hawaiians. There are people from various Asian countries who settled there over time. There are folks of European descent. There's a pretty small population of people of African descent, including, of course, the young Barack Obama. And so he comes up in a place that's really different from most of America, where the dividing line is still very much, you know, white majority, black minority, with other groups, you know, concentrated in a handful of places. The other way in which Hawaii shapes him, or his experience growing up there shapes him, is that, like lots of Americans coming of age in the 1970s, he engages in a search for his roots, his authentic self. Mm-hmm. And by the time he's in high school, he begins exploring his blackness, his African-American identity. And so he spends lots of time reading. He's already in high school, is obviously a pretty intellectual guy, and he reads famous black authors, James Baldwin, Richard Wright. He reads Malcolm X. And he finds ultimately that he begins to define himself as an African-American. He grows his hair into an afro, which was a statement of his blackness. He begins seeking out the friendship of African-descended people in Hawaii. And then when he gets to college in the late 70s, he seeks out the company of other African-American students. So he's doing what so many college kids do, right? You're trying to figure out who you are. You're trying to place your identity in this larger world of which you're a part. And he finds at that moment that defining himself as African-American seems to make the most sense.
Let's skip ahead to his experiences in New York. He was in New York during doing his undergraduate work when the city was really at a very divided point, wasn't he, Tom?
Yeah. I mean, Obama and I were actually at Columbia at the same time.
Oh,
he
really?
Graduated the year. He graduated the year before I did. I'd love to tell you that I knew him, but I didn't. I don't know that we were ever in the same room at the same time when we were there. But it was a grim place in the early 1980s. It was bitterly polarized by race. It was very poor. Homelessness was ubiquitous. And the racial tensions, you know, played out, as Obama noted in his memoir, you know, on the stalls of the bathroom, where, you know, graffitiists would drop the N-word and would, you know, use defamatory language against Jews. And these played out, you know, right on campus on an everyday basis. And he walked around New York. He explored the city. He began to see what was playing out as what he called tribal warfare. And he saw himself increasingly not called to a black militant politics like Malcolm X or Stokely Carmichael or Kwame Ture. Instead, he saw himself as someone who had a calling to help to overcome those, what he called that tribal warfare, those intense divides. And so New York shaped him, I think, in pretty profound ways in that period.
You know, Tom, I watched a lecture of yours where you characterized Obama's time at Harvard Law School as very transformative for him. What was it about Harvard that formed his political ideas and so many of his ideas about race?
Well, I think at Harvard, the place was really bitterly divided, especially over racial issues. When he was there, African-American students and faculty, the few faculty who were there, led a protest against the university's decision not to hire a prominent African-American woman professor. They demanded the greater representation of minorities on the faculty and in the student body. And Obama was sympathetic to those demands, but he also didn't put himself out there on the front line. Instead, he worked behind the scenes, talking with, listening to students who were trying to come up with an alternative route. So in a way, what Obama does at Harvard is learns bipartisanship. For Obama, he learns a really important lesson that shapes him very, very profoundly, which is that being reasonable, reaching out, presenting your argument without bitterness and animosity can help to persuade. And that belief in his power of persuasion, I think, grows out of that experience. And it worked for him at Harvard. Of course, Harvard, as bitterly divided as it was, is by no means nearly as bitterly divided as the Congress that he would have to face once he became president of the United States. But he carried that belief somehow that he could build those bridges and make those connections.
So he works mostly behind the scenes. And as you pointed out in our first half today, he did it in a way that still allowed him to be elected to an extremely prestigious post, like becoming editor of the Law Review. That's quite a feat.
It is quite a feat. And it was Obama's first exposure to the national news media. He was all over the place, interviewed in major newspapers about his experience and about his background. And I read all those interviews. It was really interesting. Obama was basically said the same thing to every interviewer, every reporter. He's so disciplined about how he talks about these issues. He clearly thought out his message and didn't really go off script very often. And that's another quality that you see carrying throughout much of his career. When he goes off script, we remember it because he does it so seldom compared to, say, President George W. Bush or President Bill Clinton, you know, who would often go off script, turn away from the text in front of them, and sometimes put their foot in their mouth for saying things that they hadn't really thought out too well in advance. Obama does do that very often, so we remember when he does.
And so this is why, at least in one part of your book, not even past the book title, Not Even Past Barack Obama and the Burden of Race, that you characterize him as displaying, and this is these are your words, the chameleonic abilities of a future politician. That's what you're talking about here, right?
Definitely. I mean, one of the keys to being a successful political figure is to be able to reach audiences, both your base, the people who really love you and care about you and are committed to you, but also those who are wavering and suspicious. And what Obama is able to do, I think, really very effectively, especially as a campaigner, is to have audiences think that he's on their side, that he understands them. So when you listen to Obama's speeches, he speaks differently to predominantly black audiences than to predominantly white audiences. And here I'm not saying, he's got two sides, that he's somehow misrepresenting himself, but rather he's comfortable moving back and forth. He can engage in what scholars call code switching. That is, he knows how to say things that speak to his black audiences. He knows how to say things that will resonate deeply with his white audiences and still somehow be true to himself, which is pretty difficult thing to do.
I think that's really interesting because I've noticed exactly the same thing. And I'm wondering, why do you think he's been allowed to move that way without a lot of criticism directed at him for doing it?
Well, it seems to be coming from who he fundamentally is. You don't get a
it's
sense
it's genuine.
That he's,
yeah.
Yeah. And it's pretty easy to hear or see someone who's putting it on for an audience. I mean, there was a moment during the campaign when Obama, tried to show his solidarity with white working class voters, and he went bowling, and it was a complete flop. He was a terrible bowler. He looked awkward in the bowling lanes, and he wasn't being himself, right? And everyone saw that very clearly. He's not going to make himself a beer drinking bowler. It's just not who he is. But when he speaks to black audiences or white audiences, and talks about issues that are kind of close to them, he won over the trust and support of enough of them to win election and re-election pretty substantially both times.
Again, we're visiting this morning. We're talking about Barack Obama and race with Tom Sugrue. He's a professor of history and sociology and director of the Penn Social Science and Policy Forum at the University of Pennsylvania. He speaks tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock over in Lawrence at KU's Woodruff Auditorium. If you have questions for Tom, we're wondering, do you think President Obama has advocated enough for civil rights issues since he took office? 816-235-2888. Is our phone number here, our email address, UpToDate at kcur.org. You can also tweet us at kcur, UpToDate. Tom, in several of your speeches, you've alluded to Obama's education at Harvard, which was called at that time, it was referred to as the Beirut of legal education. Why was it called that?
There were really bitter divisions among the faculty in particular. There were methodological differences of how you approach the law. There was a group of radical faculty called the CRITs, or the Critical Legal Scholars, on one side, and a group of conservative professors on the other side. They had really different ideas about what the curriculum should be, what the faculty should look like, and there were battles about that. There were battles over affirmative action. And those battles weren't just happening at Harvard. They were being covered by the national news media and, being watched closely by everyone who was concerned about the so-called culture wars of the 1980s. And, in a way, Obama's whole life story, at least from the time he moves to New York, is a story of finding himself on the front lines of the culture wars in New York City, in bitterly racially divided Chicago, at Harvard. So I think in some ways he's really formed by those battles over who should be in and who should be out. And he takes
Go ahead, Tom. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's okay. I was going to say he takes...
I was going to say this question I've asked our listeners, this notion of do they think that Obama has done enough to advocate for civil rights issues since he took office? I mean, do you think he has? Just your own sense of him?
No. I don't think he's been out there on civil rights issues. And again, I think he has reasons for that because every time he mentions race, in even the most non-controversial way, he takes enormous amount of political flack. He was told after the incident, maybe the most famous incident during his first term, around race, was when the Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates was arrested for trying to break into his own house in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Obama, off the cuff, a rare moment of being off the cuff, expressed his opinion that he was upset by this, and it immediately became national news for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And he was accused by his critics. Glenn Beck said this is a man who hates the white culture and white people. He was accused of playing the race card. He was accused of being polarizing, all for basically saying it was problematic that Henry Louis Gates was arrested at his own house for trying to get in, and for reminding Americans that these kinds of confrontations between black men and the police are pretty commonplace.
Yeah. You know, there is a point when you mentioned that the president back in those days had a fascination with black separatism. Tell us about that period of Obama's life and what was it that he was interested in?
Well, he read Malcolm X, the autobiography of Malcolm X, which was a book everyone was reading in the 1970s and still is a widely read book. And he got interested in black consciousness. This is, again, the moment when he's trying to figure out who he is, what his identity is. And so at Occidental College, where he goes before transferring to Columbia, he has late night rap sessions with his classmates talking about racial issues. And in New York, he goes to hear a speech by Kwame Ture, formerly known as Stokely Carmichael. But his flirtation with that version of black politics is a pretty short-lived one. He doesn't like it. He thinks that it's unnecessarily divisive. I mean, he's really turned off when Kwame Ture, after a speech, is doing Q&A and a well-meaning woman asks a question and he denounces her, to this huge audience as a sellout. And Obama's like, whoa, this is making me really uncomfortable. I don't think this is the way to accomplish the change that we're hoping to accomplish. And so he eventually finds himself attracted instead to Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., to the Southern African American freedom struggle in the 1950s and 1960s. That becomes his model. So when he runs for office for the U.S. Senate in Illinois, he begins his speech announcing his campaign with the refrain, "What would Martin Luther King Jr. do?" Not what would Stokely Carmichael do. He's left Stokely Carmichael way behind at that point. Not what Malcolm X would do.
so given this choice that so many African Americans face between King and Malcolm X, he was definitely a King guy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He takes in some ways the most widely accepted common ideas of King. Right. King has become a sort of a plaster saint. We have a dream. So the King that Barack Obama evokes in his speeches is the King who says we should overcome our racial differences. It's not the King who says, militarism and racism are intertwined, or the King who says that our country's economic system is profoundly unjust to black and white workers and Latinos alike. I mean, he's not offering up the radical version of King. He's offering up the kind of the more sentimental version of King as a reconciler, which dovetails perfectly with Obama's own understanding of himself as an agent of reconciliation.
We're visiting with Tom Sugrue from the University of Pennsylvania. His book from 2010, Not Even Past Barack Obama and the Burden of Race. Let's go back to some phone calls here. And JJ from East Lynn, Missouri. JJ, good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to hear you all talking about this.
Where is East Lynn, Missouri, JJ?
East Lynn, Missouri is about 6 miles due east of Harrisonville.
Okay. Sounds good. Welcome to the show. Good to have you.
Thank you very much. I was listening to your fine guest talking about his concern that Barack Obama hasn't done enough on these civil rights issues that he's very concerned about. And I can respect that. But I feel like in some ways it's not that he hasn't done enough, but that what he's doing has made more subtle economic impacts into those rights. I feel like with his work on the economy and with his work in the Affordable Care Act, he is going to better the economic capability of minorities and level the playing field there. And in that regard, he is bringing up their civil rights to a great deal through that more, you know, subtle method. Rather than being, as you were talking about, not a protest politician, he's trying to do it in a manner that maximizes the actual objective yield that every person has.
Hmm. Tom, why don't you go ahead and respond to JJ?
Yeah, JJ's makes some important points here. Certain programs of the Obama administration target all Americans, but have a disproportionate effect on those who are overrepresented in the working class, and African Americans are overrepresented in the working class. So the Affordable Care Act, which was his example, I think is a good case of a program that will benefit lots of people who don't have insurance, but will especially those who are working in really precarious, poorly paying, insecure jobs with employers who don't offer health care benefits. Mm-hmm. And many of those are people of color, particularly African Americans. The stimulus package too, short-lived as it was in 2009 and 2010, brought money to school districts and to big cities around the country. It wasn't specifically targeted to them, but they benefited the major economic crisis in our public mm-hmm. schools in places like Chicago and Philadelphia was staved for a couple of years because of the impact of stimulus money going into public education. And those benefits were borne by students of all different backgrounds, but definitely minorities who are more concentrated in those big city school districts. So there are definitely ways in which stealthily or behind the scenes, not in a sneaky way, but really because blue-collar and working-class folks are more likely to be people of color, that they've benefited from those programs.
And again, Tom, just in 10 seconds, you expect him to continue to be a conciliator as opposed to someone who's in a confrontation as we deal through the government shutdown and these big issues that are facing us right now?
Definitely. He's promised that if the Republicans deal with the debt ceiling, that he'll sit down and talk about issues, including issues that his supporters don't want, but the Republicans are interested in getting addressed. Yeah. So, yes.
Tom, we'll have to leave our conversation there. Hey, you've been terrific. Thanks so much for taking some time with us today.
Thank you.
Tom Segrue is a professor of history and sociology and director of the Penn Social Science and Policy Forum at the University of Pennsylvania. He speaks tomorrow at 4 o'clock at KU's Woodruff Auditorium over in Lawrence. Tomorrow on the show, we'll get an inside look from the trenches of family court, plus Brian McTavish swings by with the weekend to-do list. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. For KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.